This, the post-resurrection story from the Gospel according to St. Luke. Two of the disciples were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, for it's toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 gathered together and those who were with them, who said, "The Lord is risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of bread. I traveled back in time 35 years or so this week to my days as an intern pastor and pastoral assistant in a fairly large church in suburban Chicago. And if you're a pastoral intern or assistant, the Sunday after Easter is the Sunday you get to preach. And that's pretty much about it, a couple other times. Usually what you do is you go out into the cold and change the cute little message on the sign outside in front of the church, or you get stuck doing the lock-in youth group kind of stuff, or you visit the cranky shut-ins that nobody wants to spend any time with. But on the Sunday after Easter, you get to preach because nobody cares. Easter's come and gone, and the crowds have dissipated, and everybody's kind of tired, and okay, it's your turn. Well, as an intern, I knew a couple months in advance that this was going to be my day. And I worked and worked and worked on what I thought was a whiz-bang sermon. It had a great title, and I'm not making this up. I remember this vividly. The title of the sermon was "The Five So Whats of Easter." As in, well, now what? And I don't know how long it went, but I know that at the end of it, and I had noticed before I started preaching that in the crowd that day, the remnant of a crowd, was one of my seminary classmates who just happened to be a member of that church. And I'm thinking, well, why aren't you preaching on Intern Sunday? But nonetheless, he's a classmate and a friend, but also a competitor, so I really wanted to hit it hard. The five so whats of Easter. And, you know, everybody's walking out, and he takes my hand and gives me a smile, and all he says is, "So what?" And I'm thinking, I probably overcooked it, you know. Five of anything in a sermon is probably 40% too much. And this week, I was, you know, I never really have answered the question, so what? So I started thinking about it, you know. And on the road to Emmaus, these guys got it, sort of. I mean, they were with him for a while, and then suddenly, oh, that's what? In the breaking of bread. And, you know, we have institutionalized that and made it almost routine, but there's a "that's what" moment when we receive what we believe symbolizes for us what God has done through Jesus, the breaking of bread and the spilling of blood and so on. But if Easter's going to really matter, it's got to be more profound than that, or at least more generally apparent. And I think it is, but the question becomes, how do we know that? How do we know that's what, when the question, well, so what, comes up? This week, I always pay attention to this, because sometimes it's just a song that I've heard and won't get out of my head, but sometimes there's a message, and I had one of these what I call earworm songs rolling through my head this week, and the song happened to be the Crosby, Stills, Nash song, "Helplessly Hoping," which was written by Stephen Stills, and it was written almost as a kind of lament during a fairly lengthy and difficult and emotionally difficult breakup with Judy Collins. Helplessly hoping. Well, I took that lament and in my mind added, well, if you add Easter to helplessly hoping, how do you get to hoping with help? And that's what I've been thinking about. And I didn't even have to come up with it because oddly enough, how you go from hopelessly helping to helping with hope is in the chorus to the song. Maybe you know it. My favorite version of this song, by the way, is a cover of it by Mark Walney and Mike Pritchard that I'll put on the website after today. But anyway, the song goes, we are one person. We are two alone. We are three together. And then the punchline, we are four, and it's a play on words, we are for each other. One person, two alone, three together, for each other. And there's, you know, there's a physiological truth that we are born, we enter into our lives alone and leave our lives alone, except we don't. I mean, our birthday includes at least one other person, right? And yet there's this long sort of period of socialization and dependency that we are never really alone, one person, because we're surrounded by family by and large. But there does come a point where we have to strike out on our own in some ways. And I talk about this with my students. There are perspectives on what it's like to live in different kinds of communities. And when you study urban communities, one way of understanding how people live in places like the Metroplex and others is that it's a lonely crowd. One person, two, alone. What I thought of at that point in the song's chorus, you really can be in a crowd of people and feel all alone. And I think a lot of recent college graduates trying to make their way in a strange place are that way for a while, until they connect. And maybe it's a connection with someone who becomes a kind of lifelong or intimate partner, or maybe it's a colleague at work, or maybe that's the impetus for staying in touch with or getting back in touch with an old friend. Because two alone with one other person becomes, you know, one person, two alone, three together. Even though it's only two people. Because when any two people connect in a meaningful way, friendship, business partnership, intimate partnership, whatever you want to, level you want to take it, when two people connect, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And a third person, a third being emerges called us. A third being. And in certainly successful and thriving marriages or intimate partnerships, that third person, when energy and resources are scarce, gets it, as opposed to the individuals who remain themselves. But again, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts because two are three together. And when individuals become partners and when couples and families grow into communities, well, what's the point? The point is we are four each other. And when we are for each other, that's when I think we understand how and why and even how to make the power of Easter come alive. Human beings have a unique ability that we sometimes resist, but I think in other ways we are compelled to share. And the ability is empathy, and I want to describe it first by telling you that my cats don't have it. I have this 7 or 8 year old cat, I forget, and she was this sad, sorry, scrawny, beaten up by other cats, little waif that would probably not have lived another month if we hadn't brought her home, right? Well, and she's a nice little cat, and we like her just fine. But about 4 or 5 months ago, there was another sad, sorry, scraggly, picked on by other cats that would have lived another month if we hadn't brought her in the house that we brought in the house. And she's been living under the bed for about 5 months. In part because the other cat viscerally despises her and makes her life miserable. And I want to go to the first cat. Don't you get it? This cat was you. You should be nice. And of course they don't because they're cats. But we're better than that. We know how it is, and we know how to be. And I was reminded of an essay I'd read some time back, and apparently I've read this to you several times because I got the book off the shelf, opened it up, and the page was bookmarked. And it's worth repeating again. And this it's an essay under the title of Miracle, which is what Easter is. What's the miracle of life? In part, this essayist asks several questions. And it's in the answers to the questions that the miracle comes through and we learn how to be what Stephen Stills wrote for each other. Have you wept at anything during the past year? Has your heart beat faster at the sight of beauty? Have you thought seriously about the fact that someday you're going to die? More often than not, do you really listen when people are speaking to you instead of just waiting for your turn to speak? And most profoundly, and this little piece of this essay in just one sentence, is the essence of empathy. Is there anybody you know in whose place, if one of you had to suffer great pain, you would volunteer yourself? In other words, do you love somebody that much, or does somebody love you that much, that if they could, they would absorb your pain? And of course, the horror of it sometimes is that you can't absorb their pain. You can only walk with them. And you can be part of what is greater than the sum of its parts, three together. But being for each other has a broader implication as well. And I learned this, I've learned it in several ways over the course of my life, but I learned it in a profound way maybe, a year ago, when our now 10-year-old granddaughter in Illinois made a decision. She made a decision to give up what was a constitutive piece of her identity. This was a girl who had literally, since she was born, not had much of a haircut. She had had trims and so on. But a year or so ago, she had long, thick, beautiful blonde hair down past her waist. And that was, when you saw Katie, that's what you saw. And that was who she is and was. And then she heard about the Wigs for Kids Foundation. And on her own, she decided that she would have her hair cut and the hair sent to make wigs for kids. And you know how that goes and why kids need wigs and why other people need wigs, I guess. But you get the idea. She made that decision on her own. And that was profound enough that the word filtered through the family. And one of the other grandkids, the 7-year-old that lives in Austin, decided that, well, I can do that too. And she's now growing her hair. And in due course, she will take part in that. And that is an interesting sort of, three together out of two people. But then the punchline to the story is something to which we can all enter in, whether we have a Wigs for Kids program or whether we're in a position to do something that profound or not. It doesn't matter. What was even more important than the hair was this. As they were boxing it up, I'm told, and getting it ready and doing special mailers for all this, as they were getting it together, Katie said, "Let's put a prayer in with it." And they did. Let's put a prayer in with it. All of us can say that anytime, anywhere. And if I could dial back time 35 years and be at the end of an aisle like this in a sanctuary and meet my old friend who would probably ask me the same question, "So what?" I would say, when he said, "So what?" I would say, "Let's put a prayer in with it." So what? That's what. Amen.